LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
The suggestion is that the function of the brain and nervous system and sense organs is in the main eliminative and not productive. Each person is at each moment capable of remembering all that has ever happened to him and of perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. The function of the brain and nervous system is to protect us from being overwhelmed and confused by shutting out most of what we should otherwise perceive or remember at any moment. According to such a theory, each one of us is potentially mind at large. Most people, most of the time, know only what comes through the reducing valve and is consecrated as genuinely real. Certain persons, however, seem to be born with a kind of bypass that circumvents the reducing valve. In others, temporary bypasses may be acquired either spontaneously or as the result of deliberate spiritual exercises, or through hypnosis, or by means of drugs. Through these permanent or temporary bypasses, there flows not indeed the perception of everything that is happening everywhere in the universe, but something more than and above all, something different from the carefully selected utilitarian material which our narrowed individual minds regard as a complete or at least sufficient picture of reality. In the final stage of egolessness, there is an obscure knowledge that all is in all, that all is actually each. This is as near, I take it, as a finite mind can ever come to perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Simon G. Powell, who joins us to discuss his book, Magic Mushroom Explorer, Psilocybin and the Awakening Earth. Psilocybin, the active ingredient found in psychedelic mushrooms, is an invaluable natural resource for spiritually awakening the human psyche and reconnecting us to the biosphere and the vast intelligence of nature. Interweaving the most recent scientific studies in the United States and Britain, more than 25 years of sacred mushroom exploration, and behind-the-scenes details on the political wars against psychedelics, Powell offers a guide to safely navigating and maximizing the healing and spiritual potential of psilocybin. He explores the eco-psychological effects of wild psychedelic mushrooms, including enhanced biophilia, expanded awareness, mystical visions, and eco-shamanic encounters. He reveals how the beings and otherworldly teachers common in psilocybin experiences are actually emissaries from our higher consciousness that emerge when the floodgates of perception have been opened. He shares vivid descriptions from many of his own psilocybin journeys and shows how the mushroom offers a path of return to the ancient wisdom binding all life on Earth, a wisdom conveyed through tutorial visions and higher modes of perception. Illustrating psilocybin's healthful properties, now acknowledged by mainstream science, Powell describes his activism in the fight to keep psilocybin mushroom use legal in the UK and shows that an irrational rejection of scientific evidence underlies the harsh war against psychedelic states of consciousness. Laying the groundwork for a new relationship with our biosphere, Powell shows how the Earth's psychedelic medicines can reconnect us to the spirituality and wisdom of nature and bring the human race back from the brink of ecological and existential disaster. I must apologise for the sound quality of Simon's answers during the first couple of minutes. This problem is rectified thereafter. Hello and welcome, Simon. Thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Today, Simon, we're going to talk about your latest book, which is called Magic Mushroom Explorer. And I believe I'm pronouncing this correctly. It's Psilocybin and the Awakening Earth. Have I got that pronounced correctly?
I always say psilocybin, but you can say psilocybin. Most people probably say psilocybin.
Okay, psilocybin it is.
There's a few people who even say psilocybin.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess it's not a word that people use very much in general conversation. No. Well, for anyone listening who doesn't know, all shall become clear soon enough. Before we start talking about the book, just tell people a little bit about your background and your previous work.
I'm a writer, aspiring writer. I don't make any money from my books, but I've had an interest in psilocybin mushrooms, known in the vernacular as magic mushrooms, for about 25 years. I suppose I see myself as an independent researcher because I'm not associated with any academic institution. I'm an explorer of consciousness, interested in spiritual states of consciousness, and I've always been interested in the psilocybin experience, which is induced by these certain species of mushroom. Which grow grow throughout the UK and Europe and North America and Canada. And, the experience is so interesting as to warrant, in my case, a second book.
Now, we're talking basically about a psychedelic experience here. That's the, which is induced by said so-called, as you say, magic mushrooms. That's the vernacular. For people who are not familiar with this fungi, they'll have experience of going to the supermarket, perhaps buying mushrooms for a stir fry. So perhaps we should say something about the nature of this particular mushroom, how it's different from your average one that you consume, and also how it's different from some of the ones that are toxic.
Well, I mean, it's a mushroom. If you the mushroom that I have consumed and has explored over the last 25 years, the species is Psilocybe semilanceata. If you didn't know anything about mushrooms, it's just a small mushroom that you'd just ignore if you walked past it in the autumn. Mushrooms contain all sorts of chemicals. You get some mushrooms are deadly poisonous. There's a Amanita phalloides, the death cap, kill you. It's absolutely fatal. So mushrooms can contain different alkaloids, different substances, and there's about 200 or so species of psilocybin mushroom worldwide. They keep finding new ones, so they grow all over the earth, all over the biosphere. These species produce this alkaloid called psilocybin, which closely resembles the neurotransmitter serotonin. It's structurally very similar, and therefore it has an effect upon the human nervous system and alters consciousness. But yeah, there's all kinds of different mushrooms, and they contain different substances. I think psilocybin is probably, as far as I know, the most interesting fungal substance found in certain mushrooms.
As far as the experience of consuming these mushrooms, I mean, it's, as you note in the book, it's impossible to describe, really. But I think your phrase that you use in the book was amplifying the content of the psyche. So in as much as you can, perhaps try and say something about the experience, particularly thinking back to your first experience, again, which you recount in the book, which is very striking because, there were some surprises there for you, let's put it that way.
Well, psychedelic, the term psychedelic means mind manifesting or soul manifesting even. The earlier root of the word psyche is the soul. So, and people like therapists like Stan Grof have their definition of a psychedelic is it amplifies the contents of the unconscious. So I think I'm now of that persuasion. I think that's chiefly what is going on. And so the unconscious is vast, and there's all kinds of stuff and information down there from your life and maybe symbolic, deeper archetypal stuff at the core of the human psyche. And what these substances, what psychedelics do, is they give the unconscious becomes conscious. We get hints of that in dreams, very, you know, vivid, emotionally powerful dreams, but we're not kind of conscious during a dream. You're in a different, you're not in a fully conscious state. Whereas when you take a psychedelic, you're more conscious. So for instance, the reason psychedelics have been used in the modern era as therapeutic tools, and they're being looked at again now as therapeutic tools, is they bring into conscious awareness the contents of the unconscious. So any kind of unfinished business, stuff that's been repressed, it can come into conscious awareness and you can work through things. Same with people going to Peru to take ayahuasca, and that they, you know, they come out, they feel reborn and they've worked through certain issues and they feel healed. And ayahuasca is known as a medicine. So the psychedelics do have a medicinal, curative, therapeutic effect, and it's because the unconscious wants, in inverted commas, to be integrated, and can only become integrated if you consciously work through the contents of the certain contents of the unconscious. So that's what I think they do. And what you're referring to, my first ever psilocybin experience, which was way back in about 1986, something like that. I was a young, inexperienced young man, and it started off, it was very scary, and as I've described in the book, it was like there were all these chaotic, it was like a thousand bickering voices, and that experiences like that where you experience this kind of psychological chaos, and it's very frightening. We should remember that those kind of experiences, they're not in the substance psilocybin, they're not in the mushroom. All the mushroom is doing is eliciting this effect upon the psyche where the unconscious becomes conscious. And so that all that chaos was me. That was within my young, naive psyche. And as I describe in the book, I was very scared by this. It was a very confounding, scary experience. It was like classic bad trip, I suppose you'd call it. But I was, because I'd been studying the spiritual teacher Gurdjieff at the time, and Gurdjieff taught the art of mindfulness, as most spiritual gurus do, I was able to observe all this chaos within my mind objectively and impartially. I was able to just kind of see it. And the very act of seeing my inner world, or seeing that chaos, as like an object, seeing it that clearly, that chaos diminished, and I was able to transcend that, and then it went on to become a full blown mystical experience, and I felt, you know, it seemed like some sort of sacred divine energy was flowing through my entire organism, and I can still remember it now. I remember, like, you know, this is almost 30 years ago, and I can remember I can still remember that experience really clearly, and it was phenomenal, and it was like it changed my life, and I thought, this is absolutely incredible. This is I'm having a full-blown, I guess, like a mystical experience, and it happened, and it happens to other people, and it's a precious, fantastic thing. And that's how it all began.
I've eaten these mushrooms probably the first time I did was almost exactly the same time that you did. And by the way, I will just say they're absolutely disgusting. And I found the best way was to incorporate them into curry, which disguised their flavor and mainly their slimy texture. But I never had a bad experience, but I certainly met people who have. And I think it very much bears out what you're saying about what is already within your own mind, your own psyche, can be amplified, can be brought out, things that you are suppressed, perhaps things that you didn't even know were there. And you mentioned ayahuasca, and there's a lot of talk these days, you know, it's sort of fashionable to go on an ayahuasca tour to South America. But the important thing to emphasize here is, good or bad experience, whatever it happens to be, this is not something to be taken lightly. You know, this is not it's not a joke. People may take these sort of substances for what they would call recreation, but there's something deeper going on here, and these things should be treated with respect.
Yeah, Well, the thing is I've had some of the most enjoyable experiences of my life on psilocybin as well. And there's nothing wrong with recreation. I don't know what the definition of recreation. Recreation's a good thing, you know. But yeah, essentially they're not psychedelics like psilocybin and ayahuasca. They're beyond recreational, and they have a very serious side. And people get into trouble, I think, possibly because they don't appreciate the power of these substances. And a lot of people don't, since self-knowledge is not practiced in the West, you know, you have to read books about self-knowledge or get into Buddhism or whatever. People don't know themselves. And so they can be very surprised at the recesses of their own mind. And so, yeah, it's like, I was saying the other day, it's like, for me, psilocybin is like, it's akin to fire. I mean, when humans first discovered fire, you know, fire can be like destructive and powerful and uncontrollable, and it can cause kind of havoc and be a scary thing, fire. But, you know, approached with caution and care, and with, you know, getting information from other people and through education and stuff, fire is a boon to, you know, is indispensable for human history and human culture. And I think psilocybin is like a psychological fire. So you have to be careful when you approach it. And
just throwing in a little thought that occurred to me when you were talking about the mushroom experience itself, for people who've never had any sort of psychedelic experience, the closest I can get to it is perhaps hypnagogia, which most people will be familiar with, the strange, startling visions that we have as we're drifting off to sleep.
You know,
close your eyes, and that in itself is just a fascinating phenomenon. But the randomness and the surreal nature, you know, the way that the visions in hypnagogia appear to represent things that don't exist, if you see what I mean, that's...
Yeah. You're right. I've had discussions with people about this, because it only happens to me very rarely, and it is late at night, and it is just before falling asleep. I have it maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And after it happens, and you have these very clear visual kind of episodes and visionary kind of experiences, I always think, wow, that was very, very similar to psilocybin. But the difference is you're not fully conscious, because it's just before you drop off and actually your consciousness dissolves and you go to sleep. Mm-hmm. It's not with psilocybin, you're more awake than ever before. And so they're much more powerful. But yeah, you're right. There is a similarity there. And also, it's also akin to when those moments when you feel really alive and the sense of time changes and you feel very in the moment, you know, I don't know, seeing the stars or watching a sunset or, you know, sex, for instance, good sex or the orgasm or whatever. It's a peak experience. You know, the psilocybin experience is a peak experience. It's the profoundest state of consciousness one can have, particularly the mystical experience. You know, it's an incredible thing. It should be, we need more. I think we need to be there's so much shit happening in the horrible things happening in the world, you know, bad, horrible stuff. We need the polar opposite. And I think the polar opposite are these kind of astonishing experiences, and it needs to be talked about more, I think.
Well, talking about bad shit, I hear the police sirens in the background there, and that's the...
Yeah, they're like constant. I live in London, so...
Yeah, that's what...
No, that was probably the ice cream man. they go far too fast, though, that's the thing.
Well, I mean, any time I've stayed in London, it struck me... I live in a city, but it struck me how it's never... ever quiet.
And there's always aircraft and stuff as well.
So. Yeah.
No, yeah. I know, yeah.
Perhaps one of the most profound aspects of this mushroom experience is, again, we talked about amplifying the contents of the psyche, and you talked about when you had your initial experience that became unpleasant, how you were able to become the observer of your own thoughts, as it were. And I think that's a dissolution of the ego is... again, something that particularly in the West, that we resist the idea of it because we're so identified with our egos. But I think it's one of the most profound takeaways from that experience. Certainly, that was my experience. You know, the first time I did it, it was this I was able to become the observer of my thoughts and the observer of this person, you know, this ego who I thought I was, but then realized that's not who I was.
Yeah, we have an idea of ourselves, and we have an idea of how other people see us, and we have various ideas about our social standing and all this kind of thing, and we believe certain things about an image of ourselves and what. And yeah, you take a psychedelic like psilocybin and all that dissolves, and what it gets to is your essence. Everything that's trivial and on the surface and that has no real kind of substance dissolves, and some people find that very scary, you know, but what it leaves you is with your essence, what you actually are, you know. It gets to the core of you, your essence, rather than kind of false personality, as Gurdjieff would call it. It brings you to the truth, and any illusions you harbor about yourself, you will see through that. And it's also interesting the way you, often during the initial stages of the psilocybin experience, you'll think about significant people in your life, and any kind of bad relation. We all suffer bad relationships. I think the world is made of relationships. Relationships are everything. We all suffer from bad relationships of one form or another, or relationships that are, there's tension there, you know, either family members or work, people at work or whatever. And all this stuff you see all this very clearly, and maybe you, and it can be very useful, I think, as a psychotherapy. You can see all this stuff, and you're forced to acknowledge it. This is the scary beauty of the psilocybin experience, is that you're forced to confront all this stuff, all the neuroses and all the false stuff. And it's a powerful thing, but you always come out of it. Even difficult experiences are useful. You know, there's nothing. It's going to be educational in some way.
I think the second big realization for me personally, and this is something that, you know, I've spoken to other people who've had similar experiences, and we've discussed this, was the interconnectedness of everything. And by this, I mean, from my personal perspective, it was on a material level. That is to say that I suddenly became aware that the carpet, the television, the curtains, the cat, everything was basically connected, and so it was all made of the same stuff. And of course, quantum mechanics tells us that that is so. But that has much wider implications. I know you've written extensively, as I say, in your new book about experiences that you had in the past with consuming the mushrooms outdoors. And I think you clearly had some very important insights, you know, and revelations about, well, the nature of reality and life on Earth.
It's this interconnectedness thing it's become a kind of a cliche. If you look at studies, I've read studies that have looked at the core elements of the psychedelic experience, and one of the widely reported experience is this perceived interconnectedness of everything. And you know, I've experienced that. Many people who take psilocybin or ayahuasca will experience that. And yeah, you do. Like I say, it sounds like a cliche, or everything's interconnected, but it is. You can read about, back that up with scientific ideas and stuff. But it's very different when you perceive it directly, and it's a very valuable. It's an astonishing thing to behold, because you experience that interconnectedness directly, and it's the notion that everything. The entire universe, consciousness included, is part of a single structure, but it's a fluidic structure, and it's doing very clever and creative things. So it lends itself. I think you directly perceive the interconnectedness of everything, and you can directly perceive or apprehend this teleological aspect to everything, that everything is all being orchestrated. It might be all being orchestrated in a very slow, the dynamics might be very slow, but there is a teleology to the reality process. And now, by teleology, I mean, there's a purpose to it. There's an intelligent purpose to the whole system. And I think the emergence of life, the evolution of life, the facilitation of consciousness, they all back up this idea that there's a teleological, there's a purpose or function, if you like, to the entire system of nature, and that we are part of that. We are the human consciousness is the way, or one of the ways, that that purpose is becoming realized. You can make a good sound philosophical argument for that, but with a psychedelic like psilocybin, you can, if you're lucky, I assert that you can perceive that teleological aspect, and we are the subtitle, the publisher chose the main title of this new book of mine, Magic Mushroom Explorer, and it's the sorry commercial kind of title. I chose the subtitle Psilocybin and the Awakening Earth to allude to some of these ideas I'm interested in, and they basically revolve around this idea that we are, that there is an intelligence to nature, or a purpose, a direction to nature, and that we are that, what I call natural intelligence. We are that natural intelligence in its latest evolutionary expression. So we are, the mystery is really us. We are this mystery. And there's something, it's akin to a waking up process, I think. If in terms of the collective, we've got a lot of waking up to do, obviously. And I think it's a very gradual, Teilhard de Chardin wrote about this, you know, with his Omega point. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very gradual, very slow, gradual process. Just like when you wake up in the morning, you go from a dream sleep state and you wake up and there's like a phase transition. You know, you wake up in the morning and, you know, you're flooded with information and you wake up. But there's a chain of events that have to happen between being asleep, dreaming or whatever, and then waking up. There's all these chemical changes and, you know, physiological changes, and then you wake up. I think that will be happening over huge amounts of time with the human race as well. I mean, that's a kind of a fantastical notion, but I can blame psilocybin, I can blame the mushroom for such fantastical notions, because that's the kind of that's the kind of experience that psychedelics can elicit. They can connect you to some larger, grand, astonishing thing. I think that was picked up on in the 60s, and people felt that using LSD on you know, LSD was very popular in the late 60s. And I think that there is something, it's a potential within the human psyche to have these experiences and to get connected to a larger purposeful flow, if you like. And it probably comes in waves. I was talking, guy was asking me a few days ago about, there's a resurgence in interest in psychedelics now, and there's more psychedelic science going on now than ever before. And I said, research stopped in the 60s, but psychedelics will never be boring. They'll never be old hat and passé. The experience is always astonishing. So I think it comes in waves. I think there's I firmly believe there's a teleological aspect to reality, and that the psilocybin experience, you can feel that. And through the interconnectedness of everything, there's a kind of a large order purpose to things.
Yeah, in our modern society, we resist ideas of intelligence in nature, or, you know, in the wider universe, or, God forbid, design. But what I found about the psychedelic experience was it was one of those moments where it's just, of course, that's the best way to sum it up. Obviously, it becomes clear. And another thing that I found fascinating about the psychedelic experience was how it appears more real than real, if you see what I mean. So that when you come back to this place where we are now, it seems somehow reduced.
Yeah.
Which is curious. Reminds me of Aldous Huxley's idea, you know, about the doors of perception and about how our senses are perhaps deliberately limited for our own sanity, perhaps.
Well, I mean, we have to live. You couldn't be in that state all the time, not this in this epoch. You know, you got to eat, you got to have shelter, you got to take care of your day-to-day living and stuff. But yeah, undoubtedly, they're, well, William James, a famous psychologist at the turn of the century, said the same, that our normal, what we call our normal consciousness, is but one form of consciousness. And just off to the side, are the as it were, there are these other potential states of consciousness. So yeah, you're right. The paper I read, where it looked at the core psychedelic, the similarities between, because it's different for everyone, but there are similar themes going on. One of the, apart from the interconnectedness, is the feeling that it's more real. I mean, I get that every time I take psilocybin. You do. It's like waking up more. And that's what makes it a scary thing. You know, do you want to wake up more? You know, everything, this realm we're kind of in, the normal realm, it's like safe and we got control over it and stuff. To ingest psilocybin, knowing what it does, is it's a big step you're making, because the normal reality, everything we take for granted and the stuff we, it all just dissolves, you know, and you wake up to this a higher reality, I guess you would call it, and it can be. It's astonishing and frightening. It can be astonishing, but it can be frightening at the same time. And that's why it's scary. You know, I get scared every time. I still get very apprehensive and scared every time. You know, I don't even do it as much now. I mean, two or three times a year, maybe, but it's always trepidation there. You know, because it works, and you're going to wake up more. And it can be. I think that it's the transition which can be sometimes unpleasant. It's that transition going from normal reality to this hyper super conscious reality. It can be disorientating, but it's normally that passes, you know, and you wake up and you can have this bliss. You start having this blissful, astonishing experience, you know. So it's all good in the end.
Thinking back to what I was saying about that psychedelic experience appearing more real than reality, isn't it interesting how when you do, in that state, when you contemplate all that most of us consider important in, you know, daily life, you know, the material things, jobs, politics, economics, how utterly, utterly meaningless it all becomes.
Yeah, no, I was saying, well, it's to do with context, I think, because the meaning comes from context. Context gives meaning to things. So if your context is very limited, then of course what you wear is important, and where you shop, and, you know, who you're seen with, and what suit you wear, all this crap. You know, that's a limited sort of human context. When the context expands, which it does with a psychedelic, you perceive more, and your context expands. Then the trivial stuff is highlighted, you know, because it no longer makes sense in this larger context. You know, you imagine two people squabbling over, you know, maybe over a parking space or something in your mind's eye, and they're fighting and shouting. Imagine then scanning back from you're then seeing them from above. Pan back, and then you see the entire city. Pan back, and then you see the continent. Pan back, then you see the Earth. You see what I mean? You know, the Milky Way. The context, where the context changes, the meaning of things changes. And so, yeah, you open yourself to a bigger, ultimately cosmic context, I think. I mean, in the book, I describe lots of my experiences. My favorite way of taking the mushroom is out in the, you know, Snowdonia or the Lake District out in a national park in a secluded oak forest or whatever, with you got a campfire and the Milky Way above. You know, you really tune in to the larger cosmos then. And, all the other stuff we get, you know, get our knickers in a twist about is stupid, you know. That's another virtue of psychedelics like psilocybin, is they you become aware of the bigger picture.
I think it's the Sufi tradition, but it may not be unique to that, that speaks about today before you die. I think psychedelics potentially provide a way to do that, if you see what I mean. So rather than have that deathbed revelation that everything you did in your life, or most things you did in your life were absolutely pointless and weren't what you wanted to do or what you were meant to do, that you can actually have a similar sort of experience and still have life ahead of you.
Two things I just thought of then. Firstly, I'm reminded of Aldous Huxley in his last book, Island. I quoted him in my first psilocybin book, The Psilocybin Solution. And he was saying, you know, it is like to take a psychedelic is like a small death, and that it's better to experience that, you know, now rather than leaving it all right to the end kind of thing. So it is like a small death, but, and then you're reborn, you know, afterwards. So, it's a very educational experience.
I don't know about your personal perspective, but now, of course, none of us can really know how we will meet death until we are there in that moment. And of course, we may not get a choice. We could step under a bus tomorrow and you don't get much time to think about it. But if we know that we're going to die, if we're facing that, then this sort of experience that we're discussing can aid with that, because, again, I don't know until the day comes, but I'm not sure if I ever feared death. I'm not sure I thought about it, but a psychedelic experience made me realize the nature of that experience and how there was nothing to be afraid of.
Well, the thing is if there is a transition, if there is some, you know, death is a phase transition, a very marked phase transition, then it would have to be psychedelic. I can't imagine that it could be anything other than super psychedelic. I just remembered the other thing I was going to say about death as well. I read a study once, and they interviewed people who were dying, and they asked them about their life and what they interviewed people at the very end of their life, and they said, well, what do you regret about your life? And they said they wished they'd sort of traveled more, and they wished they'd spent more time with friends and loved ones and stuff. So yeah, you can have that realization with a psychedelic. It shows you what's important. And then the other thing that's now, I'm just thinking of now as well, is Johns Hopkins the therapeutic application of psychedelics. They've done studies and published studies where they've given psilocybin to people suffering from end-stage cancer. And you can go on YouTube and you can see interviews with these people who are suffering from terminal cancer where they were given psilocybin. And most of the subjects report it helped alleviate their anxiety. So there you go. It helped them deal with, come to terms with that, and to, you know, you don't want to die with all these outstanding issues, particularly getting back to relationships again. You don't want to die with bad relationships, you know. And so psilocybin was able to help people with their anxiety, help them deal with the situation and put things right. And it's being used now. I mean, they're pursuing that research. So it can show you what is important. And it can show you, I think it's because the unconscious knows this. You know, I often go on about the eco-psychological impact of psilocybin, that it can foster that you can bond more closely with nature, and it's like a sort of an antidote to nature deficit disorder, and it can bring us much closer to nature, or to the biosphere, or Gaia, or whatever you want to call it. And it shows you what's important, and you know, it gets rid of all the shit, I think, and you know, it points in a refreshing new direction. I'm not sort of saying it's not the only way to better the human lot and to find solutions and stuff, because there's all manner of ways of increasing consciousness. But it is a way, and it needs to be widely known about, and it needs to come out of the subculture. At the moment, right, what we're talking about is illegal. These mushrooms are illegal to possess, you know, which is crazy. Class A, you know, it's the substance you and I have been talking about is a Class A substance. In America, it's a Schedule 1 substance. That means, according to their criteria, it's the most harmful of all known substances. Psychedelics are deemed to be the most harmful, and to have no therapeutic or medical application. Well, the latter is patently wrong, because they're using it to, you know, as I say, for these terminal cancer patients, and also to treat depression and addiction. There's all kinds of studies going on now. And it's not harmful to the person. I mean, it's you know, these psilocybin mushrooms were deemed to be sacred in older cultures. So, yeah, it needs to be talked about more. And it needs to come out of the subculture. And it needs to be available to, I was almost going to say available on prescription, but I mean, it's probably too soon to say that. But it needs to be widely available, and you need to get rid of all the bad, the demonization and the sort of the oh, you're doing something wrong. And that's all crap. It's nothing to be afraid of, because it's, like I said before, there's nothing bad in a psychedelic drug. All it's doing is bringing the unconscious into consciousness, and we shouldn't be afraid of ourselves, you know, the human psyche, the human unconscious.
Oh, I think as collectively we're terrified of ourselves. I really do think we are. There's some speculation, you mentioned the medicinal benefits or therapeutic benefits. I did read somewhere speculation that the brain might be, the pineal gland might be releasing DMT at the point of death in order to ease the transition. I don't know about that, but certainly, I mean, I've done a show on the work of Timothy Leary, who actually, when you look at his early days, I mean, he's a sort of slightly laughable counterculture figure in many people's minds, but actually a lot of his early work with psychedelics and, you know, the work he did in prisons, for example, had a potential to be absolutely revolutionary. In a few weeks' time, I'll be having Dr. Rick Strassman on, and he did work with DMT in the early 90s. And as you say, there's resurgent interest now. Now, that's, of course, bumping up against this legal and political situation. And when you and I were first out gathering magic mushrooms in the early 90s or whatever it was, that there was no problem. You know, all you know, 1,000 police could come through the place and they couldn't say boo to you. And that changed in 2005. And do you know what? I didn't realize that until I read your book, and my jaw hit the floor. It was like, are you serious? This is now class A.
Yeah. Alongside heroin and crack cocaine. So I must be a really terrible person. the pineal gland thing, that is Rick Strassman came out with that theory. It's very speculative. Mm-hmm. I should point out that was his idea. It's now class A, and it, like I say, it doesn't hold up under scientific and statistical evidence, because, you know, these mushrooms have been used in the UK, this Psilocybe semilanciata, the Liberty Cap, been used since about the mid-1970s. So there's plenty of, you know, statistical data there on how many people have died or how many people have been driven mad or whatever, any negative scenario you can think of. But in papers that I've read, because I campaigned to stop the fresh mushroom being illegalized, the government have produced reports saying mushroom use was never considered to be problematic. So it's just crazy that the drug laws are, yeah, everyone knows, everyone who thinks about drug use and the legislation knows that the alcohol, if you're worried about drugs and you want to bang on about, oh, it's really bad, then look at alcohol and tobacco are the worst offenders. And even, I said it in my book, in America, maybe in this country as well, in America, prescription drugs kill more people than heroin and cocaine combined. So, you know, it's a fiasco. It's a scam. Particularly the criminalize it. It's a health issue. You know, it's funny you should say you didn't, it's a synchronicity, right? You're saying you just found out reading my book. You didn't know they were illegalized in, the fresh mushroom was made illegal in 2005. Mm. Today, just today or yesterday, I saw on Facebook someone put up a link from an article from a few years ago, and it was the Wiltshire police or something. So they had arrested 6 people. There were lots of people picking mushrooms still, and, you know, they'd arrested 6 people. And they said at the end of this thing, this policeman said, oh, the biggest danger is that people are picking the wrong type, and they're picking like a poisonous mushroom. Well, clearly then it's a health, it's got nothing to do with a criminal, it's not a criminal thing, it's a health issue. If I was using the idea I gave in my book, an analogy, if I was a mountaineer and I was using dangerous ropes, made in some third world factory, and they're really bad ropes, you know. You wouldn't smash down my door and, you know, bundle me into the back of a thing. All you've got to do is say, look, be careful with these ropes. You know, be careful if you're going to use them. They've been shown to be done. That's the only function of the state, is to inform and educate, not to criminalize and punish people, you know, the use of mushrooms, for example. So it's a health issue, and they need to be decriminalized, and you need to. Well, the other joke is that all these drugs that are currently illegal, they're known as controlled drugs, but of course they're not controlled. They're out of control. You've got armed gangs in control of cocaine and heroin production and stuff. So the whole thing's a fiasco, but particularly with psilocybin, and it can't remain. I've spoken with a researchers in America about the sort of long term plans, how they see things panning out, and if they keep having papers published showing that psilocybin, you know, can be used to treat, you know, treat anxiety in people who are very ill, and it can be used to treat depression and addiction and this kind of thing, then psilocybin will have to be reclassified, you know. And once it gets reclassified, it makes it easier for researchers to do research, because one of the reasons you only got a handful of people doing research is because it's so bloody hard to do research because of the legal restrictions. So it will have to be reclassified, and then there'll be more research, and then hopefully what I always talk about, eventually there'll be revitalization centers. There'll be places you can go where they, you know, for people who are interested in, you know, want to have a sort of a guided or some guidance, there'll be places you can go, just like with the ayahuasca now in Peru, but I'm talking about in Europe now, places you can go where you can have, where they optimize, you can have where they optimize conditions so that you can have a civilized, you know, psychedelic experience. And they should also license the, you know, people should be able to grow this mushroom at home for their own use or whatever. There should be a license vendors of that kind of thing. And you have to supply information so people can be educated and informed. And that would be more civilized. And of course, that it's a no-brainer, another no-brainer that making to prohibit the possession of something that grows on its own, that comes out of the ground. I mean, if you wanted any evidence that we've become disconnected with nature, that law alone shows we're nutty, you know. Now they come out of the ground, you know. Every autumn you go out into a national park and these mushrooms are growing. The idea that you can look at them, fine. And they grow on the queen land owned by the queen, you know. So you can look at them, fine. You can go up and touch them, fine. Oh, but if you pick them, then you'll be in possession of a class A substance. And it's insane. It's absolutely insane. It's got a fictional quality to it.
This notion of facilitating a psychedelic experience, that's sort of Leary's idea of set and setting, isn't it? You know, how to optimize that.
But some people are perfectly happy. I did research on my own, independent research. But I know there's a lot of normal people, in inverted commas, who are interested in this whole subject area, but maybe they don't know how to get any mushrooms and they don't have time to grow them and all this kind of thing. If there was a place that they could go and they could have as little or as much sort of guidance. One thing is when they administer psilocybin, well, for instance, Roland Griffiths published a famous paper about 7 or 8 years ago now. This is Johns Hopkins again, very auspicious university. And they gave psilocybin to healthy volunteers, and the majority of them had very rewarding mystical experiences, which they said were amongst the most significant spiritual experiences they'd ever had. For some of them, it was the most spiritual experience they'd ever had. And that was all done in a sort of a very nice environment with nice artwork on the walls and nice music, and there's a therapist there, like a guide, and they don't interfere much. They're just there as a sort of an anchor, you know, if you like, or a guide. But they created conditions that could facilitate And that's what you do. Set and setting. It's important that you're in a good, safe environment, you know. So the civilized thing to do is to offer for people that are looking for that kind of, environment, cultural environment, official cultural environment, as it were. It should be there, you know, that would be a civilized thing. I think it may happen in the fullness of time.
Talking about the medicinal angle again, you're seeing and the potential for psilocybin going forwards, psilocybin, sorry, I will get that right. You see a lot of pressure now, particularly in the States with cannabis, you know, being decriminalized and being prescribed for medicinal purposes. So maybe something similar could happen in future.
Yeah, you need licensed vendors. I think the main thing is people need to be, you know, like if you go into a chemist and you buy, I don't know, some ibuprofen or, you know, codeine or Viagra or something, there's information comes with the medicines. It tells you, well, you know, don't take it for this. Do, you know, be careful for this. You got all this information. That's the only function of the state is to make sure people are informed and they get what they're paying for kind of thing. And that's a civilized thing. So I could imagine you'd be able to get these kits, these mushroom grow kits, where you could grow the tropical variety, Stropharia cubensis or whatever, and it comes with a little booklet, and then you go online. Maybe there's a web link, and you go online, and there's some information, you know, some videos, and so you do everything you can to optimize a rewarding experience for people. That's civilized, right? Tell me that's not civilized.
Well, of course, it's the same as you noted, the drugs that are legal or illegal in any given society, any given age. It's not quite arbitrary, but it's a matter of choice. You know, we've chosen to have tobacco and alcohol and chosen not to have Mother Nature, you know, the mushrooms, cannabis plant, whatever it happens to be. And that wasn't always the case, and it won't always be the case. It just, we have to put up with the frustrations of, you know, politics and the law getting involved where they have no place.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you've got to remember that, you know, the politicians and the lawmakers are all there. The state is paid for by ordinary taxpayers like you and me. They work for us, and we often forget that. They become like nanny figures. You know, you forget that we're paying for them. They work, they're our employees, right? They work for us. The policemen you see in the street, the army, they're all paid by ordinary people. So they work for us, and their job is not to nanny us and wave fingers and all this is immoral and this is no. Their job is to educate and inform.
Oh, when I hear politicians, the last one who used to go on about all the time was Tony Blair. When I hear that they have a vision for Britain, then I know there's problems ahead. But no, politicians' jobs should be to order, to take delivery of, and to count paper clips. And that should be all they should be doing, you know, to say nothing of all the cocaine on the toilet seats in the House of Commons.
And the four subsidized bars.
Yeah, there's a lot of hypocrisy there.
Oh, man, there was a series on. I caught one of the shows about inside the House of Commons. It was the first time the cameras were allowed inside the House of Commons. And they give free snuff. It goes back a long way, right? There's a guy, you know how stupid all this old, it's just so old-fashioned, you know, there's a guy standing at a doorway and they give free snuff to MPs going in. It goes back hundreds of years, you know, and this guy snorted some snuff, you know, and he said, that's good, strong. I mean, this really happens, you know. So, you know, what drugs they say are okay, alcohol, snuff and tobacco, that's all fine, but you know, mushrooms. All no, we got. Let's see the other ridiculous thing with mushrooms. I was thinking about. It's supposed to be a health issue, right? They'll say, "Oh, you're endangering your health, so we have to put you in front of a judge. We love you so much, we got to bundle you into the back of a police van and put you in front of a judge. That's how much we love and care about you." You know, there are mushrooms that I mentioned it earlier. The death cap, Amanita phalloides, right? That will kill you. But there's no prohibition about owning them. Why not? You know, if it was all about health and danger. So the whole thing is it's a scam. It's like a, It's a corruption. It's a corrupted human kind of thinking, you know.
Well, this is the same government that cares so much about our teeth that it puts fluoride in the water.
Yeah.
Because it's really...
Whether you like it or not.
I'd rather they just paid my dentist bills, to be honest. You know,
that would
make worse. And wasn't Queen Victoria, for example, just talking about how things change with the ages, Queen Victoria was off her face half the time, as I understand it.
And Coca-Cola, originally Coca-Cola, the name Coca-Cola comes from the two principal ingredients, which was coca, mm-hmm. the coca plant, which is cocaine, and cola, the cola nut, which you get caffeine from. And so cocaine was it when in the original Coca-Cola, there was cocaine, you know. And you used to be able to buy opium and laudanum and stuff at the chemist. So
yeah, that's what I was thinking of with Queen Victoria was a laudanum, yeah.
And people, there's nothing wrong or immoral in changing your consciousness, you know. It's the drug situation at the moment, the demonization and criminalization of drug users, and particularly drug addicts, is in a way that sort of nannying and, oh, it's wrong and, you know, we want zero drug tolerance. In a way, it's similar to the way homosexuals were treated back in the 50s, well, even in the 60s, you know. If you've seen the new Alan Turing movie, Alan Turing, you know, the father of computers and helped to win World War II by breaking the German Enigma code. You know, he was hounded to death because he was homosexual. Lou Reed had, electric shock treatment or something when he was younger because of he was homosexual. So that attitude, which is now, we think, well, that's crazy, you know. That attitude is a bit similar to, I think that the drug issue will be seen in that light in the future. You know, we think, oh, on earth, why did we have such this, why was it all criminalized? And, you know, it's normal human behavior to take to, you know, I've said in the book, if you, right from when we're young children, I think probably all young children at some stage spin around and around and around and they get giddy. Yeah. You must have done that. Everyone does. You spin around. Yeah. You discover that if you spin around fast, you get dizzy and you stagger around. All children do that. Why do they do that? And why do we love fair rides? You know, really fast rides at the fair or whatever, because we like the change in consciousness and we like sensations. Why do we like sex? You know, we're sensation seekers. So it's not to discover substances in the environment that change consciousness. That's normal explorative behavior in humans. That's the way we are and we like that. The thing to do is to do that in a, to use substances in a judicious way, you know, and not everything in moderation.
Yeah, I had a recent guest on, actually, and we touched upon the subject, you know, the function of sex and specifically the orgasm. And he pointed out that for many people, the orgasm is the only time when their monkey brain will stop throwing up all this random nonsense that the ego does. It's the one point where they're kind of, their mind is still, if you see what I mean.
Well, no, I said earlier when we were talking about peak experiences and the closest some people come to those kind of experiences. Yes, I mentioned sex as one of them because at that moment when you're during, you know, you can have peak experiences during sex and you feel really alive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is to be human and to feel really alive and to feel in the moment. To have a, you know, to experience vibrant consciousness, you know, it's a wholly good thing. We need more consciousness. Consciousness is variable. I think we operate generally in a low state of consciousness. I mean, Gurdjieff, who I mentioned earlier, you know, said that man was asleep. And, so anything that can wake us up, make us more conscious, make us more aware, that can induce more empathy. We need more empathy for a start. Because as Terence McKenna said, that one of the problems with us is we don't feel the consequences of our actions. Mm-hmm. So we do all sorts of horrible things because we do not feel the consequences in other people of what we do. So, we need more consciousness and, there are various tools for provoking more consciousness. And psilocybin and ayahuasca are among those tools. So they're not the only way, but they are just ways. And like I say, I'll say it again, they need to come out of the subculture and they need to be more widely available and they need to be properly integrated into culture, because at the moment they are not integrated, unfortunately. The exact opposite, in fact. They're prohibited. And they carry these criminal sanctions. And there's this aura of criminality around them. It's crazy.
Yeah, most of us are lost in the past or the future, aren't we? And or a combination of both. And I think it's as Yoda says to Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, you know, never his mind on where he was, you know, always lost in some date.
Another good synchronicity, I've got a magazine here I was reading this morning. It's called Evergreen, and it was like a subculture magazine from the 60s. And I'm reading this issue from 1967. And there's an interview with a hippie guy, all about a hippie scene. And this is like 1967, Summer of Love. It's a really long interview with this hippie guy. There's one thing I remember, there's one thing he says. It's a bit sort of dated, some of it, you know, sort of hippie jargon. There's one thing the guy said. He said that it was... The whole psychedelic LSD thing was kind of anti-intellectual, because intellectuals are always in the past or in the future. Intellectuals are always talking about the past or talking about the future, whereas psychedelic brings you into the living moment, you know?
Yeah, it's all we have, isn't it? Just right now, you know?
But we're always worrying, you know, we're always worrying, fretting about tomorrow or the next year and stuff. And we're not in, so consciousness is never... One of the reasons it's asleep is because there's all this mechanical stuff going on, thoughts buzzing around our mind and stuff, where a psychedelic wakes you up more. It wakes you up to the moment.
Thinking about what you said about this natural tendency, you know, you're talking about as kids we spin around, and I clearly remember doing that. I would go out in the green in the front of our house and I would spin around, and then I would fall on my back and look at the sky, and it would all be like spinning around. There's an issue also here that, you know, we're not alone in this. There's a lot of documentation about how animals will eat psychedelic substances. There will be natural fermentation that will take place that will produce alcohol in some types of fruit, for example, which animals will eat. So animals like to get high as well. You know, this is not unique to us by any means. It's not an aberration. If anything, as you point out, thinking about indigenous societies, and I think it's natural. And there's also, thinking about your whole chapter on natural intelligence, there's also the issue I've often pondered, you know, nature doesn't do things for no reason. You know, these things have been created by nature. They're there.
I see it as the existence of these plants and the effects they elicit within the human psyche. And like the curative effects and the sort of the culturally significant effects. Yeah, I mean, it's a single interconnected system. So it's a very interesting question why these mushrooms produce psilocybin, you know. I think it's partly because all life uses the same kind of ingredient. So the fact that plants and, you know, fungi produce substances that can be similar, very similar to neurotransmitters. This is the same kind of Lego bricks are used in this, the life everywhere uses the same building blocks. And so that's one reason. But I think there's also a synchronicity there that they're there, these substances, because they have to be there. And there's like a fictional, it's like a life on Earth and the history of life on Earth and the history of humanity. I often think it's like a story. It's an unfolding. Well, yeah, I've said before, there's a self-writing story, as in it writes itself and it sets itself right when it's off balance. It's a self-writing story. And so there are these like plot devices, and I think it's a kind of a synchronicity that right when we need, right when we've got this terrible break from the biosphere, you know, we're totally fucking up Spaceship Earth, as Buckminster Fuller called the biosphere. You know, we're messing up all the controls and we're trashing this beautiful, wonderful organic technology that is life on Earth, the whole of life on Earth. Right at that moment, you know, you've got ayahuasca coming out of the Amazon and there's more and more of these psilocybin mushrooms being discovered everywhere. And so it's like a, you know, they're catalysts that can heal the, act as an antidote to materialism and, you know, our break from the bigger picture. We need to get back in touch and in harmony with the bigger picture and with the larger field of life, the larger network of life, or the life support system, which is the Gaia or the biosphere. We need to get back in harmony with that and, you know, find our proper healthy place within that larger system. So it's no surprise, really, that there are these substances within the biosphere. There are like these, in space, using the spaceship Earth analogy again, you know, there are sort of buttons, you know, we've discovered there is a, behind this panel, we can press this like an emergency button and it sets things right, you know. So, yeah, it's not an accident that these substances exist.
If anyone thinks perhaps that you're being melodramatic here, I would say absolutely not from my own experience, because referring back to what I said earlier about understanding interconnectedness through the psychedelic experience, I mean, it can be absolutely transformative in the way that you see the world. Your attitude, your approach to you know, life, the universe and everything changes forever, even through one experience. Again, in my experience, that's the case. And the world would be a very different place if more of us kind of saw through this lens.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing, like I say, I mean, there are similar, if you were to interview 1,000 people about their mushroom experiences, people are going to have different experiences, but there are these key themes, and people do have mystical experiences, and they do sense the interconnectedness of everything, and it's valuable. It's a valuable thing.
Just another random thought to throw at you here: contemporary science, particularly that, you know, in quantum physics, is calling into question basic concepts such as time and space. And I actually found that the psychedelic experience induced that in me, because I'm not a scientist, but it really did make me think again about some of these so-called fundamentals that we take for granted.
Well, time changes. One's experience of time changes, and time can, you go through moments where you think and feel about a lot of stuff, but only like a few seconds has passed. So time, it often feels like you're breaching eternity. I can't say I know exactly what is going on, but it also highlights the fundamental nature of consciousness, because all we know is our consciousness. And matter, and when we talk about atoms and Higgs bosons, well, these are all ideas, really. They're ways of enabling us to talk about our experiences with the larger world. But consciousness is fundamental. And I'd like to see more scientists and physicists and cosmologists take psilocybin to see if that, because they've got a lot of problems at the moment, and physics is having a hard time trying to understand what dark matter and dark energy and stuff. And I often think that as a boon to creativity, a lot of these scientists might find some answers that they're looking for, because psilocybin allows you to break out of the rut of normal perception and normal conception. We're always thinking in the same direction. It's like we're stuck. You know, it's like the route, the paths we take every day. We often walk the same kind of path or on the same journey every day. And it all becomes dim and we don't see things. But if you take psilocybin and go outside or whatever, you will see, well, everything looks as if you're seeing it for the first time. So, and it's an astonishing thing. So when a quantum physicist tells you that consciousness is bound up with that you can't separate the observer from the observed, that mystery there of consciousness and its role in reality, I think you can explore that. It comes to the fore during the psilocybin experience. You realize how profoundly important and fundamental consciousness is. Consciousness, you know, perception is reality.
Thinking about inspiring scientists, I think, look at the DNA experience there, you know, directly attributable, I think we can say, to psychedelics.
No, that's a myth.
Oh, is it? Okay, well,
I'd like to have the opportunity to take down that myth. There is no evidence that Francis Crick, discovered the double helix structure with the aid of LSD. That comes from a scurrilous, I think it was a Daily Mirror newspaper article. There's no hard evidence of that at all. I read a writer, I forget his name, a popular science writer, interviewed Francis Crick's widow about it. And yeah, he did. He did take LSD, but he took it when everyone else was taking it in the late 60s, like 1967 or whatever. So, and the discovery of the DNA double helix, that was like 1954. It's a myth that you see it a lot. It's a myth. But there have been other scientists who've used, there's a guy called Carey Mullis, who discovered the polymerase chain reaction. And he got a Nobel Prize, I think, for discovering that. And he used, he openly said that his creativity was boosted by LSD. And like Steve Jobs said that LSD allowed him to see. And yeah, a lot of these people in Silicon Valley have used psychedelics. So it's a boon to creativity.
Okay, well, I apologize for attempting to perpetuate a myth then, but you live and learn. And one thing that we'd all be good to get better at is saying, okay, I'm wrong. So.
Well, no, it's a myth. You see it everywhere. You go on Facebook and you'll see your top 10, famous people who have used psychedelics or, you know, scientists have used, and you always find, Francis Crick discovered the double helix. No, he didn't. This comes from a really horrible, crappy tabloid story, the Daily Mirror, really rubbish newspaper, and it was a sensational, you know, thing, and it was published right after Crick died, I think, you know. But it's a myth, and we don't need it. It's you don't need that myth to highlight the virtues of psychedelics.
No, look how many good and bad records have been a direct result of psychedelics. I didn't know that Lou Reed had undergone EST.
Know if it was that. He had some. They tried to force some treatment on him when he was younger.
ECT, I meant. Well, it might explain his album Metal Machine Music if he did.
Oh, right.
just zooming out, Simon, to big picture. Here, Graham Hancock delivered an interesting talk a couple of years ago called The War on Consciousness. Regarding the politics and the law around psychedelics and specifically the mushrooms, what do you think's behind this? Because a big picture conspiratorial view says that there is some force, some tendency, because you can't even go as far as to call it an entity, that's trying to constrain an expansion of human consciousness. Other cases will be made that it's much more mundane than that, and it's just all wrapped up in drugs generally. You know, there's money involved and corruption, etc., etc. I mean, what do you think's driving it in your experience?
Well, I'm reminded. Well, it's an interesting. You know, I'm not a fan of conspiracies. It's interesting that Terence McKenna once said that the mushroom had a sort of protection around it, and one can imagine that a lot of the laws and the kind of the fact that people are being kept away, you know, maybe it is part of it's not people that are doing that. That would be the easiest thing to say. Well, it's people and, you know, government officials are keeping it from people. But it might be a bigger reason. But the way I often think about this is, you know, getting back to when you're asleep and you're dreaming. I don't know if you've ever had the experience where you're dreaming. You're fast asleep and you're dreaming. There's a noise in the environment coming from outside your house or an alarm. And then that your psyche incorporates that noise into the dream. Have you ever had what I'm talking about?
Absolutely, yes.
Right. Well, it's an astonishing thing. So what, cause it's so creative. It's like the mind wants to keep your brain or your organism, the nervous system you're being kept asleep by, you know, must probably chemical means, and so the sounds from the outside are integrated, so you're kept asleep because it's not time, you know, your body, you're not ready to wake up yet. And I sometimes think maybe it's like that with culture as a whole, because I think what's pulling the strings is this larger natural intelligence. And I think the waking up process is very slow, so it's almost like these, when psychedelics do become, are flowing freely through human culture in a sensible way, that will be akin to when you wake up and then you get these chemical changes and then you do actually wake up. So it's like everything in good time. So I think there are deeper reasons beyond politics why, if you look at the whole dynamics of psychedelics in modern culture, I'm thinking of the right from when Huxley wrote The Doors of Perception in 1954 and then Gordon Wasson discovered the psilocybin mushrooms in Mexico in the Life magazine article came out in 57. And then you look at the whole 60s thing and it's sort of that it comes in waves. I think there's some sort of purposeful teleological dynamics to it all, and that what is in control and what is governing all this is not just, there's some sort of higher dynamic at work. And as I say, it's fictional. I mean, this was brought home to me when I was lobbying Parliament and the fiasco of the way the drugs bill was passed in 2005 and the way they outlawed, prohibited psilocybin. It had a sort of fictional quality to it because it was so stupid as to be almost fictional. And I think I'm not saying there's a cosmic joker, but it's almost like there is a kind of authorship to everything. And like I say, everything in good time. It's almost like we can't wake up. If you imagine that collectively, the collective human psyche, if you were to give it a name, is becoming slowly, very slowly becoming more and more conscious. And that the things will get better as kind of time goes on, and we'll become kinder. We'll become a kinder species. There's some sort of dynamics to it. It can't just happen. You can't click your fingers, and then everyone puts down their weapons and stuff. There's a process there. So I think there's some sort of natural process going on that's beyond politics. I don't think there's a clique of people that are saying, we've got to stop psychedelics getting to the masses or whatever. I think there's just like a fear there. It's a fear of the unknown, really. And like you alluded to it earlier, you said people don't want to, are afraid of themselves, you know, and some people don't want to face themselves because they have an inkling that they don't know themselves and they don't want to face these deeper aspects of themselves. So I think there's a fear there among politicians and political leaders and stuff. I don't think there's a conspiracy as such. And there are, you know, the drugs, if you've seen that film, The House I Live In, undoubtedly it's an industry locking up, criminalizing people, putting them through courts, putting them in prison. That gives lots of work and a lot of income to, you know, private prison companies and to lawyers and judges and the police and, you know, anti-drugs people. There's a lot of invested interest in keeping the situation as it is. But I, beyond all that, if I might wax metaphysical and mystical, beyond all that, there are other dynamics at work with psychedelics, I think, and with higher consciousness. And there's, it's unfolding at its own pace, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, as far as politicians go, I think they're some of the most frightened people I've ever seen, to be honest. But just in closing, I like your thought of evolving consciousness. Well, I say it holds out hope, but that's, you know, yeah, say hope as Obama espoused it in his election run is fairly useless, but it holds out some sort of promise for the future against a background where a lot of people feel that somewhere down the line, we as a species took a wrong turn, yeah, and that we're somehow on a downslope of a civilization. And again, you mentioned in the book how this could be just the very beginning of this greater entity waking up to itself.
It's a very slow process. There is an awakening going on. I used to get repeatedly on psilocybin, I would have these visions, and they would often involve a man and a woman in like a suspended animation machine. There was this idea that something was kind of asleep and that would then wake up. And I often felt I was it feels like you're waking up more, you know. So it can happen on an individual level, and I think it will happen. All these spiritual teachers, if you look at all these gurus, and I'm thinking of Gurdjieff and Krishnamurti and Buddhism, and at the heart of all religions probably, it gets back to consciousness, and we need more consciousness, because you can only shoot someone in cold blood or cut their head off or whatever, or, you know, punch the living daylight. You can only do that in a low state of consciousness when you're consumed by anger or whatever. Consciousness is like a light, and when consciousness is boosted and you become more conscious, you're not going to be as consumed by negative emotions. It's negative emotions that are one of the chief causes of the problems that people have. People get caught up in negative emotions. But if you apply consciousness and mindfulness, and you start to see the contents of the inner world becomes illuminated. It's like the analogy I often give. It's like negative thoughts that consume us and act like cancer. They're like cancerous things, and they poison us because we carry around all these, you know, like chips on our shoulder. These negative thoughts and relationship problems, they're like animals, and the light of consciousness is like a bright car light. And when it shines on those wild, uncontrolled animals that are running around causing a mock, you know, they freeze, those animals, in the headlights of consciousness. So negative emotions, when you see them, and when you see the you see within your own psyche, within your own inner world, those negative thought patterns and stuff, and you see them as, because that's all they are, mechanical thoughts that are going around and around and around and around. When you see them, you become free of them. So it's very important, because the other thing is, in order to increase consciousness, we have to be talking about consciousness more. And people don't talk about consciousness. As I've said loads of times, it's like, just like fish will be the last to discover water because they're in water all the time, so we've yet to discover consciousness because we're sort of in it all the time, you know. So it's very important, in order to raise consciousness, we have to talk about consciousness. And then, of course, if you're talking about psilocybin or ayahuasca, it's all about a change in consciousness. So it's very important, I think, to talk about consciousness in order to elicit higher, more vibrant, more expansive forms of consciousness. You need to be talking about consciousness to get that. So,
Well, Simon, today we've been talking about your new book, which is called, once again, Magic Mushroom Explorer, Psilocybin and the Awakening Earth. That's available on Amazon, all the usual outlets. Tell folks about your website. You've got a couple of documentaries online, which we'll be linking to, and just anything else you'd like to share.
Well, you can just bung in SimonG.Powell on Google and all my stuff will come up. My two films, Metanoia and Manor, both free to watch on YouTube. They're both full-length documentaries.
Excellent. Well, Simon, thanks so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were £7, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.